Okay, I'd like to call the back to order, the Regional Water Quality Control Board. And we have a report, I'll call it item 5, Small Disadvantage and Financial Hardship Determination for the North Coast Region Communities. And we'll call on Connor McAtee, and we have a related item that a lot of people will be interested in, and that's possible funding behind some of the concerns that are documented. So with that, we'd like to call on Connor McAtee.
Good afternoon, Chair Corbett, members of the board. My name is Connor McAtee. I'm an environmental scientist here at the North Coast Region, and I'm here to talk to you guys today about a staff memo that was presented to you on small and disadvantaged and financial hardship determination for communities in the North Coast Region. So I want to give you an overview real quick about what I'm going to be talking about. I'm going to talk about a little bit of the background, how this project kind of came to the forefront of mine and other staff and management's mindsets. The purpose for the of the analysis, along with some funding opportunities that are available that are going to be touched on a little bit more fully here in the next presentation, as well as some of the details of the analysis, getting into that, including the criteria for the determination, the findings that we made, and then a few brief conclusions based on those findings. So for the background, economic constraints are often a topic of discussion between staff and the regulated community. Process that's put through the board, be it a regulatory order or an enforcement action, there's conversation about what are the economic realities that are resulting from what it is that's being put forth. And oftentimes those come in form of constraints is what staff has noticed, that more often than not we're having that conversation about the constraints resulting from that. It had been anecdotal evidence over time kind of got staff's attention to wonder if this is something that's more than anecdotal, and is it something that's systemic in the region? So we decided to take a little further look. But looking, before we get into those details, looking at some of the challenges that are faced by some of these small and disadvantaged communities, there's a long list, as I'm sure that you guys are aware, but to touch on a few of them, oftentimes these communities will lack resources to consistently comply with regulatory requirements and build and maintain facilities or the improvements that are necessary for it to comply with those requirements. Sometimes they'll have an inability to be able to recruit and retain qualified operators, including the lack of ability to be able to pay a competitive wage for these operators. There's difficulty sometimes in paying penalties that are associated with permit violations, as well as a lack of in-house resources to secure funding for grants and loans or to be able to plan and implement capital improvement projects. The sparsely populated rural nature of the region can magnify these economic constraints. The economy of scale that the communities don't have makes it difficult to obtain the funding necessary to repair the facilities. Because of these challenges, amongst other reasons, many small and disadvantaged communities utilize old and undersized wastewater treatment facilities and water supply systems. For disadvantaged communities, finding funding options for project implementation is imperative for success, as Alita kind of alluded to and talked about as part of intimate part of their process in the Russian River, is finding pairing funding opportunities with those individuals and communities that are in need. Thankfully, though, there is a variety of resources that are available. Small and disadvantaged communities within the North Coast can tap into a variety of technical assistance and funding resources for the planning and construction of needed water quality, including wastewater projects. Several of these sister agencies are here with us today, and they're going to be presenting in the next item. but I just wanted to touch briefly upon them. The Division of Financial Assistance, the Rural Community Assistance Corporation, the North Coast Resource Partnership, all provide technical assistance in one degree or another, some financial assistance for these communities, and you know, like such as the Division of Financial Assistance, which administers grants and loans programs. It's also noted here that we use the Division of Financial Assistance criteria for the determination for small and disadvantaged communities. There are also other funding sources such as the USDA, the Department of Agriculture, and the California Department of Water Resources that also provides sources of funding as well. So let's go a little bit into the narrower scope of the purpose of the analysis, which was to determine which counties and communities served by wastewater facilities face financial hardship or are considered small and disadvantaged, which is based on the one of the two criteria here, the Division of Financial Assistance criteria and the Water Quality Enforcement Policy criteria. There's a number of communities that were not analyzed in this report because they're either not serviced by a wastewater treatment facility or they're too small to be considered a designated place by the U.S. Census, and so information wasn't available. But we feel as though that this initial analysis here is fairly representative of the North Coast region, and those communities that were not analyzed likely face similar financial realities or potentially even greater financial constraints, economic constraints than those that were analyzed, just given the fact that they would be smaller and without some of the basic services that these larger communities do have. This memo is coming at a time when there's a variety of opportunities for the regional and state board staff to work with the disadvantaged communities to help them achieve compliance and protect water quality. The criteria analyzed in this report will help guide funding opportunities and enforcement decisions and provide staff with a useful tool in prioritizing our efforts. So into the analysis itself, the 10 counties that comprise the North Coast region, either in whole or in part, were analyzed, along with 60 communities throughout the region. The data that was collected from the U.S. Census Bureau's ongoing community survey. That data is based on five-year estimates because specific economic data was not available. The 2010 census did not ask for specific financial information, and only five-year estimates are available for small communities, which comprise the majority of the North Coast region. And so for consistency's sake, we use those five-year estimates, even though some places like Eureka and some of the larger designated places do have a little bit more specific information, yearly estimates, but we use the five-year estimates to make consistent analysis. Some important notes about the analysis. It's a snapshot in time of the economic landscape. It's something that will change, but we wanted to provide a moment in time for that level of understanding. It does not identify specific projects or communities that are eligible for funding from DFA or eligible for compliance projects with the enforcement policy. It's focused primarily on communities served by wastewater treatment facilities, and some of the data does have a wide margin of error. When you're looking at the California median household income, for example, the margin of error ranged from plus or minus $1,500 to plus or minus $98,000. So there's some communities that have a very wide margin of error. And for communities that have some of that margin of error, there's an option to be able to do a community-specific income survey to get more specific information from the county or from the community if the community feels that it would be in their interest to do so. So, looking at the criteria that we use to determine the status of the communities and the analysis. The Division of Financial Assistance criteria, to be considered small and disadvantaged, a community must have a population of 20,000 people or less and have an annual median household income that's less than $49,191, or 80% of the California median household income. To be considered...
Can I ask you a quick question, Carter? Yeah. How do you define community?
That's a good question.
I mean, some cities are bounded and they are incorporated, so they have a legal boundary. But how about a rural county?
Just as a county?
Yeah. How about a little town out there that's not incorporated that's in a rural county?
So if it's an unincorporated town, it would not. I don't believe it would be defined.
And that might be something that the division.
We service area.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's like a CSA type thing.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
That's just for communities that have a wastewater system.
Yeah, sorry.
Which is what we focused on.
I should have probably made that connection because those are legally defined, right? A community service district is legally defined. So you're probably right.
Yeah.
Go for it. Sorry.
So to be considered severely disadvantaged, the community must have a median household income of less than $36,893 or less than 60% of the California median household income. And a community larger than 20,000 people wouldn't qualify for the Division of Financial Assistance grant funding opportunities but may still qualify for low-interest loans. In the enforcement policy criteria, the second criteria that we use to be a community considered in financial hardship, the community must have a population less than 10,000 or reside in a rural county and meet one of the following three criteria. Have a median household income less than $49,191, similar to the Division of Financial Assistance criteria. Have an unemployment rate of 10% or greater. Or have a poverty rate that's 20% or greater. And those statistics were taken from the U.S. Census Bureau as well, those metrics. The regional board may elect to allow communities with financial hardship to implement a compliance project in lieu of paying penalties and enforcement action. So we have kind of that ability. So what were the findings from the study, the important part here? 8 out of the 10 counties in the region face financial hardship and may be considered disadvantaged as counties when you're looking at it at a county level landscape, kind of not looking at the population but simply based on the economic piece of it, the financial piece of it. Glen, Lake, Humboldt, Mendocino, Modoc, and Siskiyou County meet all three financial hardship criteria. And Lake and Trinity County as counties are considered severely disadvantaged. Marin and Sonoma counties were the two counties that were found to not be considered disadvantaged or face financial hardship. But it's important to note that within those counties, even though as counties they may not be collectively disadvantaged, there are still individual communities that can qualify. So let's look at this geospatially. Landscape of our region, you can see that Sonoma and Marin counties in hash there are not disadvantaged. But the majority of our region at a county level shows there is a level of disadvantagedness. These figures are, the numbers on the figures are the same as the figure numbers in your guys' memo. And then the communities are shown in blue triangles. Those are ones that do not qualify as small and disadvantaged per the division financial assistance criteria. And the red circles did. And you can see that it kind of follows in line that there's more communities in Sonoma and Marin counties that don't qualify as at the community level for financial hardship. And it kind of flips into the other direction into communities that do in the other counties, as would make sense. There's a similar graphic here that shows the enforcement policy criteria, but it's very similar in its results, and so didn't need to go over that as well. But the enforcement policy criteria shows similar geographical results as well. So in Figure 3 in the memo in here, this is just a pie chart showing the percent of North Coast communities that are considered disadvantaged based on the Division of Financial Assistance criteria, and you can see that 40 out of the 60 communities, or 67%. Of the communities are considered small and disadvantaged, with 23 communities or 38% being considered severely disadvantaged. There are only 16 communities or just 27% that are not considered small and disadvantaged, and Four of the communities had a population that was larger than 20,000, and so we're not eligible to look at for the financial criteria for that. It's Eureka is the one town that if it weren't for its large population would be considered financial be considered disadvantaged. So it's by their population that they're not eligible. Whereas the other three large communities also have an income that would not qualify them. So looking at the enforcement policy criteria, you see that, again, 77% or 46 of the communities qualify with financial hardship based on the enforcement policy criteria, whereas only 14 or 23% don't. And this figure is the one that I think kind of tells the best story. The figure was adjusted for scale to be able to fit here. So the more complete one that you'll see is in your packet, and that's why it's printed on 11x17. But this just shows on a community level, individually lined up, what the median household income was for each community. And you can see on the far left here, you have five communities that are above the California median household income and would only qualify for a state revolving fund loan if they were to go after a project. And the California median household income at 100% is here in this red line horizontal, where if you fall below that, the Division of Financial Assistance would cover potentially up to 50% of the project costs. And the interesting factor here is that 90% of the communities, or 54 out of the 60 communities that we looked at, make less than the California median household income as a community. So it's categorically almost every single community. Then if you look at the 80% threshold, you have the 67% of the communities. 40 of the communities make less than 80% of the California median household income, and so the DFA would potentially cover up to 75% of the project costs. And then 40% of the communities, 23 of the communities, DFA would cover up to potentially up to 100% of the project costs for those communities. So what conclusions can we draw from this? Well, the North Coast region consists primarily of small and disadvantaged communities. Many of these communities have limited funding and resources to make capital improvements on their facilities. And many communities in the region weren't analyzed, but they likely have similar financial constraints, although further analysis would be required if we wanted to make that statement definitively. You know, there is state and federal funding available to help these disadvantaged communities, and it's important for staff to take the necessary steps to prioritize those communities in need and match with the ability to fund projects along with projects that are needed encourage compliance in the best manner possible. And the implications of this analysis are relevant beyond simply community wastewater systems. There has been an increased demand on water resources at community levels from recent expansion of cannabis cultivation, for example, along the North Coast. There's a draw on resources that's not happening just in remote reaches, but in and throughout all the communities, somewhat systemically throughout the North Coast. And we're seeing that there is a need for water supply systems as well to be looked at as something to be either upgraded or enhanced in a way to help deal with some of those issues that are coming about. The increased strain on all the systems in the region has elevated the need to augment water supply systems, wastewater systems, incentivize groundwater sustainability, stormwater capture, and water recycling, all of which are programs that have levels of funding in one way or another throughout through some of these entities that are here today to present. Adequate resources must be provided to the region to assist these communities in complying with water board regulations to ensure the fair treatment of communities of all incomes. As the state and regional board are committed to assisting disadvantaged communities to achieve environmental justice and protect the human right to water. Through this analysis, staff have identified the need to further reach out and assist disadvantaged communities within the region, along with our partners at local, state, and federal levels. And hopefully we'll be able to utilize this to help better prioritize our efforts moving forward. So with that, I'll take any questions that you might have. Thank you very much.
Any board member question? Valerie.
Not a question, but just a quick comment, and that is that I really appreciate your work on this, in addition to the sort of practical implication for financial assistance. I think it's just a really poignant reminder of the people and communities we serve in this region, so I appreciate it from that perspective as well.
You're welcome.
Any other board members?
Well, I just want to say I appreciate a proactive approach. I know on mandatory minimum penalties, this board was very active in trying to get them to adjust downward to a rural area, and given that's who's out there, if we don't have a proactive approach, those people are just left high and dry. And so I really appreciate staff having the sensitivity to go into this issue and develop proactive programs. So thank you. Okay. I will call on the public speaking slips. And first is Brian, is it Gerving? From the city of Eureka.
Well, good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the board. As the board knows, back in June, you approved the, Brian Gerving, Director of Public Works for the city of Eureka. As you know, back in June, this board approved the new NPDES permit and wastewater discharge requirements for the city of Eureka's Elk River Wastewater Treatment Plant. And we appreciate the efforts of staff in developing that permit and the associated CDO. I understand there were concerns from the board regarding the extended compliance timeline, and that's understandable. It is a long time, but what Connor has discussed today really highlights why that's an issue for us. What he's presented really shows what difficulties we'll face as we determine how best to comply with the terms of the permit, particularly the Bays and Estuaries policy and the new prohibition on the blending of primary treated wet weather flows. Either one of these new requirements stands the chance of triggering many millions of dollars in improvements to our treatment plant. As you'll note in reviewing the information presented by your staff today, the city of Eureka is in a unique position among agencies in your jurisdiction. First, we're the only large community with a median household income less than 80% of the state average. As Connor mentioned, that means we have the dubious distinction of being the only large community that would meet the criteria for being considered disadvantaged if population were not a consideration. The other large communities have MHIs near or above the state average. In fact, the MHI for Eureka is just over the severely disadvantaged threshold, so close that it's within the margin of error that Connor discussed. Unfortunately, with water and sewer rates already at or above EPA affordability guidelines, I believe that additional principal repayment and debt service costs may be difficult for our customers to accommodate. I'm confident that this board understands other factors that result in significant long-term increases in operations, maintenance, and capital expenditures, both for both our water and wastewater enterprise funds, including aging infrastructure, increasing healthcare and PERS costs, and over the past decade and a half, a 600% increase in the cost of our wholesale water supply. We're committed to overcoming these challenges and continuing to be good stewards of Humboldt Bay, which we view as a critical asset for the North Coast. In order to do so, the City of Eureka appreciates staff's effort to bring some of these funding constraints to your attention, and I encourage the board to consider developing alternative funding mechanisms that will allow us to continue to enhance water quality while ensuring long-term financial stability for the City of Eureka and other agencies in your jurisdiction. Thank you.
Thank you. David Long.
Good Good afternoon, board members. David Long, I'm a principal at Brelgian Race Consulting Engineers. I also function as the district engineer for the Forestville Water District. I apologize, I have marbles in my mouth, but I have Invisalign as a new teeth treatment thing going on here. First, I'd like to send out a big thank you to Connor for bringing this matter to your attention. I was here 4 or 5 years ago to speak about a similar topic, mainly the inequity of the $3,000 minimum mandatory penalty that's applied to all districts across the board, no matter how large or small they happen to be. And so I hope that it's just another nail in the ladder to making it easier for small districts to function. Forestville recently received the administrative civil liability of $210,000 for violations over the past 5 years, and many of those are related to constituents in their discharge stream that were subsequently proven to really not have an effect, such as copper in concentrations that aren't harmful to aquatic life and testing for cyanide that is subject to false positives from preservatives being added to the sample because Forestville does not, or they're not located within a reasonable driving distance to a certified laboratory to get the test done without a preservative. But even though those constituents were proved to, you know, not be detrimental to the environment, they're still on the hook to pay this $3,000 in minimum mandatory penalties for each of those. So I'm just coming back to say, I know you can't. I've had meetings with Tom Howard and his senior staff at the state level. I know the Migdon thing is a difficult situation. You can't easily undo the $3,000 minimum mandatory penalty situation for everybody. But in Forestville's case, they are in the enviable position of not qualifying as a disadvantaged community. And so they thankfully have 10% unemployment in their community. And so they'll be able to spend the $210,000 on a compliance project rather than throwing it into a black hole. But there's got to be a better way. And I'm just hoping that you on the board can be a catalyst to establish some kind of sliding scale for the minimum mandatory penalty situation. $210,000 represents 26% of the Forestville's annual operating budget for their wastewater system. Y'all remember the PG&E San Bruno pipeline explosion? That thing leveled an entire community, killed 8 people, you know, burnt up acres and acres of property, and they recently received a fine of $3 million. That is 0.02% of PG&E's annual operating revenue. So just a kind of real-world example of how out of whack the MMPs are. Thank you.
Thank you. And then, like I said, this board has had a history of trying to get the legislature to modify the mandatory minimum penalties, and they did make some changes, but not nearly enough. Matt, is it Matt Fronberger?
Good afternoon. My name is Matt Fronberger. I'm the general manager of the Forestville Water District. There's several salient direct and indirect points that this report brings up, or this memo brings up. There's a profound difference between the method of categorization for purposes of determining if a district or city is disadvantaged between in the enforcement policy and the division of financial assistance. Our district is eligible for consideration of a compliance program, like David just spoke about, but from the enforcement side, but not able to meet the criteria for financial assistance to complete an actual compliance project. And compliance is the goal of enforcement actions. The relative size of a district or city is not deemed relevant issue to pursue when dealing with the application of fines, as long as the population is less than 20,000 people. A district that has 400 connections that receives a fine of $200,000 equates to a cost per connection of $500 per person, per connection. Whereas a small city with 8,000 connections equals $25 per connection. The same city was to receive a fine of $500 per connection, the fine would be $4 million. A sliding scale based on population served would be more appropriate and should be considered. Lastly, the financial health of a district or city should be a consideration when applying fines for noncompliance. When a district or city is faced with fines of any magnitude, it can be financially devastating to that entity, crippling or possibly bankrupting the agency, or causing them to assume more debt, thereby increasing costs for customers for decades into the future, and not necessarily addressing actual compliance with regulations. This is a complex issue, and sometimes complex issues need complex solutions. A one-size-fits-all approach policy is easily understood, defensible, and enforceable, but not a true solution to the ultimate goal of compliance. Thank you.
Thank you. Dave Lemer, Great and Sour Sewer District.
Hello, my name is Dave Clemmer. I'm the board president of the Great Sewer District. One of my comments was answered by Connor's report, and it was a very good report. So what I was going to say, he pretty much answered it for me. But I would like to make a comment that if anybody doesn't know where Grayton is, we're between Sebastopol and Forestville. And we are a very small community that is under financial hardships, and we're also a disadvantaged community too. We were lucky enough to get a SRF loan to help our plant with major upgrades, and now we produce Title 22 water discharge. So I just want to thank the board for letting me speak, and thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Gary Harris, Forestville Water District.
My name is Gary Harris. I'm on the board of directors of the Forestville Water District. You've already heard from our district engineer and our general manager. What I would like to explain to you is that we also run a sewer system. We have 400 connections on that sewer system. And when we have to do a wear study, for example, that costs $50,000, I think you've already heard this, but you divide that over 400, it's $125 per ratepayer, as opposed to, say, a $40,000 community or a 40,000 ratepayer community, that's $1.25 per person. So I am a person who has a business in town. I pay the rate, and the ratepayers see me all over town, and they constantly ask me about our increases, and it's quite hard to explain to them some of that kind of thing. So we appreciate Connor's work on this. We just hope you do understand how it affects small communities. There comes actually a breaking point. I don't know where it is, but I can kind of see it out there, you know, in the future. We can't afford all of these required things. Thank you.
Thank you. Adam Lee, Trinity Hmong Community.
Good afternoon, board and the chairman. Thank you for this opportunity. My name is Adam Lee from the Trinity Pine. I'm representing a group of people called Hmong, H-M-O-N-G. And long story short, I'm going to make it very brief in this one here before I go to the other thing. Hmong people are the people who live in Laos is a minority. We're the one and only chosen sons and daughters who fought with the United States CIA during the Vietnam War. We were being recruited by Bear Lear and fighting, cutting the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And after the war, we have no place to go. We were being persecuted and exterminated. So we moved to Thailand, and the United States came and invited us to move here. We're not typical Asian. We're very special Asian. we fought with sacrifice and contribute so much to the United States, but it was never been taught in high school or college, so nobody knows about the Hmong people. Don't take my words. Please check on YouTube, Secret War in Laos by the CIA, and you know more about us. General Vang Pao is our father. And that's a little bit brief about the Hmong people, but as Connor testified and present his documents, we are in the pine and we're severely disadvantaged, not just disadvantaged, because of financial hardships, because of language barriers, and because most of them cannot read or write or have proper education. So many of us live there without running water, without real sewage system, without electricity. And because we're mountainous people, we live in the mountains of Laos, we learn how to survive with with propane and with gasoline, we survive over there. And I'm here to inform the board that the Hmong people and the Hmong community wants to participate in this process of improving water quality and building infrastructure. We're not looking for free ride and money, but wanted to work collaboratively with the water board and other governing bodies and agencies to make improvements in the Trinity Pine. More than anything, we wanted to work in compliance with water boards. I myself personally have self-registered with water board, but I have asked many of my fellow Hmong people, and they have no clue what water board means. They never heard of the words. So there's a lot to do here as far as information needs to be passed to these people, and so that everybody is aware of what's coming and what needs to improve the quality of the water. And this is the only earth we have. God doesn't make any more land. So we wanted to work with the water board and many other agencies out there to be in compliance. And last but not least, I'm confident that this board will not overlook at the Hmong people, and that I'm encourage you to look at us and assess more about what we're doing and what we're going through. And I want to thank you for your time. Thank you.
Any board questions or comments? I just wanted to thank you for coming here. I want you to make sure you feel welcome. And do you have three ideas on the most effective way we can have outreach to the Hmong community that we can pass on to our staff?
I believe that having a consulting committee or agencies that can really just inform, getting the information to the people, and maybe hiring a few of those people, to network and to connect the people at the Pine. That would be the first steps to make sure that everybody's aware of what's going on.
And then I did want to just personally thank the Hmong people for supporting the United States during the war, and I realize that came at considerable sacrifice.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
This isn't, for one thing, thank you, Connor, for the information, for the bringing this to the front. Surely disadvantaged communities, the financial resources are a huge part of this. The other part of it is really, what's been discussed here by most of the speakers is really about MMPs, the accrual of MMPs, and basically what that does here. This board, I think, in my time, and Bill Massey, our friend Bill Massey was a champion of the small community districts, and the real cost of running those districts. I know we don't set MMPs. We don't very much control that kind of stuff, but what else can we do? Is there something this board can do to interact at a level with state board, with enforcement? The last thing I've been vocal before too about, the last thing I want to do is have a community write a check to the state of California for basically wastewater discharge infractions unless they're real. I think that's a real hard thing. And at times, with some of these criteria, it sounds like they can go fully into a compliance project, but that is real money to these small communities. So I put a question out, what else can we do as a board? I know that a lot of this is set at the state or legislative level, so is there things we can do that we're not doing now?
So it's a good question, and I think we'll need to report back to you. I mean, I think that as a regional board and as staff, I just think it's important to emphasize what you said, that MMPs are set by the legislature. So it would require legislative action, I believe, to change it. I can certainly elevate it to the state and regional boards management coordinating committee that I sit on.
Well, and I'm sure we're not alone here, Matt.
Absolutely not.
This is everywhere.
So, Board Member Noren, I just wanted to mention that the board does have the authority to issue time schedule orders, which can be used to delay the implementation of an MMP or excuse the implementation of an MMP as long as that schedule of compliance is met.
And I do think we could actually write a letter to the state board itself just to keep the issue on the front burner. A little bit in deference to them. They tried quite a bit with the legislature and were not as successful as they wanted. Then two members from this board as individuals did approach local legislators. And after multiple legislative attempts, there was a slight modification that's more favorable. But that's an option that maybe needs to be exercised. And then I believe the state board did support the final changes, but we need to tell them it's just not enough. And I do know they're deeply involved in environmental justice issues, and this is clearly one of them. And so it might be timely to remind them that the best way to do it is have a set of laws that can deal with people's income.
Well, certainly, Mr. Chair, I think if we look at the criteria here of whether that be the DFA criteria or the enforcement criteria, I think the interest is clearly there. I think the information and the criteria has been developed for either by a population base or medium home income. It layers completely onto this type of small disadvantaged community. You're absolutely right in environmental justice and social justice here. The last thing I want to do is have a community write a check that it takes it out of their pocket. If a sewer lift station fails, a pump fails, and it has a sanitary sewer overflow and it accrues a $3,000 or $10,000 fine, the last thing I want you to do is to go write a check to the state. I'd rather you fix the pump and put that into the infrastructure.
Mr. Chair, just to echo Mr. Noren's comments, I'm in 100% agreement. I think what we're after as a board is compliance. And absolutely, if somebody writes a $250,000 check, that money should go into fixing and achieving compliance. So even if our request to the state was to allow a board to have that level of autonomy, that we could, if it's a bad actor, you're going to have to pay a fine. But if it's somebody that has a long track record of working with us, we can work something out. The penalty is reverted back to fixing the problem that's been identified. I'd be 100% behind that. The other thing, too, about the city of Eureka, it strikes me as odd that if you're economically disadvantaged, what difference does it make what size, how many people are in the community? And there's that, to me, is another rub. You know, you either are or you aren't. And, again, when we have these county and city and regional partners that want to work with us, these kinds of impediments, we need to see if we can break them down.
Well, the other part of this, Matt, is I think I would request, you know, Nate, you brought up the fact that we could use time schedule orders. I would imagine that there's probably a burden, or at least not a, I don't want to call it a burden, that there is a workload associated with that, and that I would be interested in then how we could do that, how you could take an MMP that upon request from a discharger to put it into a time schedule order to get to a fix. And that it gives us some, maybe that's a tool we could develop and use. And I'd like to hear more about that in the future. That if we can do that upon request from a discharger, say Forestville, say that happens at Forestville or Grayton or something like that that fits under these criteria. Because with that, then you could probably pair it up with a funding source to actually help you go fix that problem. Maybe.
And I did want to say we started, had our staff develop language to reopen for reopeners to avoid some of the mandatory minimum penalties for your smaller districts. And when we first started, it was brand new, but I don't know, did that get adopted statewide? In any case, we've given advice, because what happened is the big dischargers had their engineers and lawyers, and they said, oh, you got to put in a reopener, and the small districts didn't. And initially, we just went through with the standard permit language. So we did adopt that we were putting in those reopeners in their standard language now. And but we need to do more, because it's still quite a problem.
Could you please look into that and get back to us? That'd be wonderful. Thank you. Thank you for your comments today, by the way, people.
Any other questions or comments? Okay, we will go on to...